This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And my counterpart officer, other assistant operations officer, made a landing plan for Tel Aviv. And we figured that if we had to use his plan, you know, as I say, we'd be wiped out, but if we used my plan, we'd probably do very well. Now, coming then, when I was doing, 8 years later, I was doing this study. And I actually got access in the study I was doing for the RAND Corporation, but I had very high-level access, and I was allowed to spend weeks and weeks in a huge vault with shelves. It was the eyes-only, not only top-secret, but eyes-only vault for documents, very sensitive documents, and it included the correspondence between Kennedy and Khrushchev in the missile crisis, and much earlier, all the earlier correspondence had gone on between Eisenhower and Bulganin and Khrushchev and so forth, just shelves of this stuff on the book. So I was comparing histories of Suez with what I was reading in these very secret documents, which included transcripts of telephone conversations between Eisenhower and Dulles, for example. And this included even conversations that, a very critical one in particular, that Dulles had with Eisenhower while he was at the Burning Tree golf course. And he had a radio with him, and Dulles was calling him. The upshot of all this, what I started out to say, was that I realized that Dulles throughout that crisis was on a very, very short leash. He took orders from Eisenhower on, in some cases, at the height of the crisis, on almost an hourly basis. Eisenhower was totally running this affair. And whereas the such a book as Herman Feiner's book on Dulles, which had access to a lot of classified information, and Feiner was a former official, but only partial, and he hadn't had this, and it had given him a totally false impression. He had the impression, as a semi-official historian here now, that Dulles had been on his own. He was quite critical of Dulles. That Dulles had decided to nationalize the canal on his own. I'm sorry, to refuse funding for the canal, which led to Nasser's nationalization of the canal. And he had Dulles doing this on a what he regarded as a typically impulsive, emotional, ideological reaction to the Egyptians' arrogance, you know, when they threatened that they might turn to the Russians for funding. Well, in fact, as the files showed, we'd been discussing that contingency in detail, what to do about it and the likelihood of it and so forth, for days and days before that and for periods before that. And Eisenhower was giving the detailed instructions to Dulles as to how to proceed. Dulles had no initiative on that one at all. And then later, that was true of every step of the crisis. So that gave me quite a different impression of presidential leadership here, because Eisenhower benefited to some extent, and also suffered to some extent, from the impression that he cultivated that this policy was Dulles's, and he was off playing golf. Yeah, but he was a working golf player, just as they often tell us, you know, and so forth. He let Dulles take the blame for a policy that might be a problem. And he was even willing to let Dulles have the credit when if it turned out well. He detached himself. I've always suspected that even someone who gives every evidence of having been removed from reality, like Reagan, you simply cannot tell that from outside. It surely was true to some extent. But it could well be true that Reagan was much more in charge. Well, we did learn, you know, with Irangate, of course, that Reagan may have forgotten later what he'd been told. But at the time, he was closely in charge of this crazy policy, you know, and wild policy of selling arms to Iran for terrorists and backing the Contras, et cetera, et cetera. So, in short, I developed then a notion that was confirmed in the Pentagon Papers for Vietnam, that to a large extent, our policy is run as a covert operation is run in such a way as to provide, quote, plausible deniability for the president, to enable him to blame underlings, whether it's the Secretary of State or CIA or someone else, for reckless or costly or immoral or illegal policies, and self claim some detachment from it. What the Pentagon Papers showed me later, for instance, was that time after time, and very specifically under Kennedy and then under Johnson, the impression that the president was simply following military advice in what he was doing was flatly untrue. Time after time, I found the president going against, typically, in fact, against the advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in various ways. And the policy that was emerging was presidential policy. And yet, to this day, managing to keep the impression, biographies of Johnson that come out still manage to ignore the evidence of the Pentagon Papers and say he was following the advice of his Kennedy subordinates, let's say, or his the people he carried on, or the Joint Chiefs of Staff and so forth, and ignoring the great deal of internal evidence that the advice he'd given and the estimates he'd been given were entirely different.
Before moving on from the 56 Suez War, I'd just like to, some clarification here. Under very stern U.S. objection, Britain, France, and Israel withdrew from the occupied zones of Egypt. What do the documents reveal in terms of planning aggressive action if there were no withdrawal? Was there any such contingency plans?
By the U.S.? Good question, and I would say no, that there wasn't. Now, what there was something recurrently, you know, that kept coming back in the 67 war to some extent, and then again in 73, very, very intensely in 73. And that was a proposal by the Russians that they join with the U.S. in restraining U.S. allies, in that case, the British, French, and Israelis, in other cases, the Israelis, but that the Russians, who were more aligned with the Egyptians, would somehow act with the U.S. to separate the warring parties. And on each occasion, of course, the president of the time was willing to take the most extreme threats now against the Russians to prevent their entering that area in any guise whatever, including the guise of a neutral mediator or of a peacekeeping force of any kind. Of course, I think you were asking, might we have pushed the British and French back by force? And I would say no, definitely not. I certainly never came across any such evidence. But we were very, very strong, of course, in pushing back any suggestion by the Russians that they had a legitimate role in that area. And if the Russians had taken unilateral action, which in several cases they threatened to do, in 73 they apparently proposed, if you won't join with us, we will move unilaterally as a peacekeeping force to separate these forces, you know, to enforce a ceasefire. In that case, we said, we would take very strong military action. And, of course, in 73, we actually threatened the use of nuclear weapons very consciously. That was a very complicated case. But 73 was a very strongly nuclear crisis. And in three ways, you could say, from the Russian point of view, from the Israeli point of view, and from the U.S., all three invoked the possibility, possible use of nuclear weapons in that case. But the recurrent theme was to deny to the Russians the notion that they had any role to play as a global superpower comparable to ours. Now, from one point of view, you could say, why is it more obvious that we have a right to, you know, intervene and play a role in that area than they do? It's a hell of a lot closer to them than it is to us. Well, of course, it's not their oil at stake, in the sense that they don't depend on the oil of the Middle East to the degree that we do. So we think of it as our oil, and therefore our oil, our area to a considerable extent. And of course, we have our ally, the Israelis. But then the Egyptians, the Russians by that time, were acquiring an ally in Egypt. So I come back to a very key point is this. If you ask, let me raise a very broad question. What has the role of nuclear weapons been in world politics over the more than 50 years now of the nuclear era? Certain answers that are usually given, such as they prevented a Russian attack into Western Europe, can easily be seen through as as not very substantive, because there wasn't much ever any much indication that the Russians had any intention or desire to go into Western Europe. But then there's a temptation almost to say that it didn't have any, it didn't make any difference, that the lines were drawn in such a way that it would have been the same had there not been nuclear weapons. I think that's misleading. I could name several areas where the U.S. policy had a firmness, let's say, and an ambitious, was ambitious to a point that would not have been likely without U.S., without nuclear weapons, and specifically without the threat of initiating the use of nuclear weapons against Russian forces, even though Russia had the capability to retaliate after 1949. Our policy was premised in several respects, important respects, on an ability to make a sufficiently credible threat of initiating nuclear war against Russian forces. Now, one of those uses, which is not in people's minds very much, was very simply to keep Russia out of the Middle East, and not only out of Saudi Arabia, which we regard ourselves as owning and controlling, but out of Iran, right on their very borders. As a matter of fact, the first claim of an effective first-use threat of nuclear weapons, what would come to your mind if I asked you that?
I think it's Azerbaijan in Iran.
Very good. But you know, not everyone would come up with that answer, right? That's right. Truman claimed after the event that it was only his threat of nuclear weapons that had pushed the Russians out of Azerbaijan, where they were occupying at the end of, in northern Iran. Northern Iran, at the end of World War II, and that they had wanted to extend their stay there, but he had told them that he would use nuclear weapons if they did. Now, historians in general dismiss that. They regard it not only as a bluff, but they doubt that the threats were ever made. There is no documentary evidence to this day, whatever, that any such threats were made of nuclear weapons. There were clear indications that we might use force at various points, but no documentary evidence of indicating nuclear weapons. However, northern Iran is a place where we have essentially no ability to confront Russians. We can barely could imagine confronting Iranians logistically or any other way without using nuclear weapons. And I do know, this comes to some other crises, that in war games at the Rand Corporation and in the Pentagon, in the late 50s and early 60s, looking at Iran, it was always taken for granted that Russians could be kept out of Iran only by first use of nuclear weapons. That, of course, gives retrospective credibility to Truman's claim. There's a second point. I should say, by the way, this is dismissed almost just uniformly by historians, despite the fact that Truman made it on the record on several occasions later. They just say, oh, he's making that up. You know, it's just they find it very convenient to just ignore it if they want to. They have two reasons for wanting to. They don't have the documents on the one hand, and they go very much on that. But more than that, they typically have not taken seriously the allegations of threats of nuclear weapons. Now, I do take the Truman threats with some seriousness. He may have misremembered. They may be wrong. If made, they may have been totally bluffs. All that is possible. But I don't dismiss them by any means, because you have to see those in the light of 40 years later of recurrent threats of just this sort, and in that area as well, and threats which were just as undocumented for many years. In many of the later cases, we now do have documentary evidence, but that wasn't available for a long time. This is something that's kept very, very secret. So the lack of documents doesn't mean that there was no event of that sort. Now, the point is that, as Paul Nitze said in a debate that he was in, a three-way debate with Kennan, Truman, and Nitze, in about 1950, he said, there were areas in the world that we just could not hang on to without a credible threat of initiating nuclear war. Kennan was for a no-first-use policy. And he specifically named Iran as one of those places. Now, that's Iran, but that's true of the Middle East as a whole. Of course, the further south you get, the more effectively, with the help of the Sixth Fleet, we could confront Russian forces. They get farther from their borders and so forth. But we would always have, it would never be easy. It's always a lot closer to them than it is to us. They could also take action against the Sixth Fleet if they were willing to, you know, risk real big escalation. But they could do it. So, in short, I'm saying our goal in the Middle East was and is to this day quite ambitious in this respect, which is to keep the Russians from playing any active role whatever in that area, which is right on their border, and to deny the legitimacy of it, and above all, to just make it impractical because it was too risky for them. And that has always relied on the first use threat of nuclear weapons. We couldn't have, I don't believe we could have kept them out of the Arab-Israeli question, of the Egyptian question, of any of these questions, to the extent we actually have, without that first-use threat. You could ask, so what? You know, why bother? How important is it? That's a little harder for me to answer. But the fact is that the nuclear threat did enable us to carry out this quite aggressive and ambitious strategy. You have no business there, whatever, in other words.
About 4 or 5 years ago, Oliver Stone came out with a film called JFK. A series of books came out about the same time by Fletcher Prouty, John Newman, Peter Dale Scott, and many others, in fact. The central thesis being that Kennedy was preparing the groundwork for U.S. military withdrawal from Vietnam, and that was urgently linked to his assassination. Now, what's the documentary record on the former allegation?
Let me take the latter allegation first. I'm not convinced even slightly. I don't take it very seriously that his assassination was linked to any such, to his Indochina policy. I'll give by the way, what I think is a rather conclusive evidence of that, or indication of that, in my mind, that I've never seen mentioned by anybody else. The supposition there is that the people who wanted to stay in Vietnam and to try to win in Vietnam found the idea of getting out so threatening that they were prepared to get rid of him for that. Those are the very same people who were involved in the debate, which was an intense debate at the highest levels of the government, about a coup against Diem. And
so who are we talking about here? The Bundy brothers, McNamara?
No, we're not talking about the Bundy. We're talking about some of the military in this case. But the people who are accused, I think, by the way, they're wrongly accused or understood to be determined to keep us in Vietnam, either of the Bundy brothers or McNamara. And I say that not as their advocates or fans, but as my best historical understanding of it. But certain elements of CIA, certain people in generals, in the Joint Chiefs as a whole, were certainly strongly on record that they felt we should try to win in Vietnam, and they were against the coup against Diem. Actually, to answer your question right away, we can just look up at the lineup on Diem. The people who were against the coup in Diem were Lyndon Johnson, who wasn't, you know, terribly active on Vietnam policy, but was a player. He had been sent as a representative of Kennedy in 61.
Yeah, and he called Diem the Winston Churchill of Asia.
Came back with that and took a very strong position that we should not only back Diem to the hilt, but should send combat troops there to Vietnam. He was in favor of that. Lyndon Johnson was in favor of that in 61. Had the assassination of Kennedy taken place in 61, I have no doubt that Johnson would have sent troops in 61 or 62, by the way. You know, that was foregone, virtually, that Lyndon Johnson would send troops to Vietnam. Now, but at the time of the coup, McNamara was opposed to it. John McCone, the head of CIA, was opposed. The Joint Chiefs across the board were opposed to the coup. If you wanted to stay in Vietnam, let alone win in Vietnam, you certainly would have backed Diem at that point. The notion that we would do better at pursuing the war without Diem was held by a couple people at the periphery of decision-making, including Henry Cabot Lodge, but our ambassador. But he's an example of someone who had just arrived in Vietnam with no previous experience of the situation at all. That was an ignorant and foolish position. He actually did have some optimism that we'd do better without Xi'an. But that was held by almost no one who knew anything about Vietnam. Whether you liked Xi'an or didn't like Xi'an, it was clear our imperial role there was better served by Xi'an than it would be by anybody else. And therefore, if you wanted to stay in Vietnam, then the important thing to do was to head off, was not to kill Kennedy. It was to head off the coup against him. And that didn't require killing Kennedy. And on the contrary, first, so you'd want the assassination, let's say, before November rather than after November, before November 1st rather than after November 20th. But you didn't have to kill Kennedy to head off that coup. All you had to do, and it's, in a way it's astounding that it didn't happen, considering the passions that were involved here, was to leak it. All you had to do, basically, was to tell the American public that a Catholic president was in the process of contemplating the overthrow of a Catholic head of state, with the probable killing of the Catholic head of state, his brother, his family, and his archbishop brother, another brother who was an archbishop, Catholic archbishop, who had had up to that point the backing of Cardinal Spellman. That coup would not have taken place. That was a very easy coup to stop. Given that there were people who did feel passionately, it is quite interesting that in a way, that secrecy held at that level of the secret government, which is headed by the president, the invisible government, which does exist, but it has to be understood as it doesn't, whatever cabals and conspiracies do exist below the president, basically it's headed by the president. The president runs a secret government, a secret foreign, so that he can run a secret foreign policy in pursuit, of course, of corporate interests and partisan interests and various interests. But if they were majoritarian, well, or if they were consensual interests in the society, he wouldn't have to be secret about it. But the covert operations make it possible for him to serve various special interests without being accountable for that. And the secrecy is so tight, it is so great. The ties of loyalty, the oath of omerta, the silence, is so comparable to that of the early mafia. I understand it's eroded a great deal in the mafia for some reason now. Would that were true in the U.S. executive branch. That's wonderful. We should find out what has happened to the mafia, you know, to make some of them start opening up. You know, there's a lot of Ellsbergs in the mafia, if I may say, put it that way. And would that there was true in the executive branch. I wish there were more. But it didn't leak, so the coup took place. So in short, I would say any of those people who are alleged to have wanted, you know, to hand off his Vietnam policy could have done it much. The urgent, immediate thing was to avert the coup of Xi'an, and they didn't do even that. And after that, you were in much worse condition to do anything winning in Vietnam, although we continued to fight the war. Now, the next thing was that they certainly would not have expected, and they would not have been right to expect, Kennedy to do anything toward getting out of Vietnam before the election of 64. So they had a year. There was no big rush about that. And with or without Xi'an, then, you didn't have to do it by killing Kennedy in 63. At third, as I think we've seen in Watergate and elsewhere, the CIA and the Joint Chiefs have a lot of ability to unelect a president if they want to get rid of a president. And if they didn't like the way Kennedy was going, they had a great deal of power to affect the election of 1964. I don't think assassination was not the way they would have had to go.
You were just listening to Daniel Ellsberg on Origins of the Vietnam War. I talked with him in 1998 in Boulder, Colorado. Daniel Ellsberg will forever be honored and remembered for his release of the Pentagon Papers. He passed away on June 16th at the age of 92. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Medea Benjamin, Noam Chomsky, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Daniel Ellsberg on Origins of the Vietnam War, and for Norman Solomon's new book, War Made Invisible, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Blood Rock. Thank you, Daniel Ellsberg.
I want to thank you, Daniel Ellsberg, for all the notes that came from you. You, Daniel Ellsberg, and maybe Lois Stack would do. Oh, while scheming out all the schemers, you now have set a trend for you. Thank you.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you from Simon Fraser University's Burnaby campus in British Columbia.
Coast to coast.